So I'd like to devote this last section of the weekend to the contemplation of equanimity, the fourth of the Brahmaviharas. The word in Pali is upekkha, but interestingly, upekkha translates both as equanimity and as indifference. It's the same word, which perhaps points to how close the shadow side of equanimity lives to the actual quality. I'd like to start with a poem I'm sure many of you know by Billy Collins, called Another Reason Why I Don't Keep a Gun in the House. The neighbor's dog will not stop barking. He's barking the same high rhythmic bark that he barks every time they leave the house. They must switch him on their way out. The neighbor's dog will not stop barking. I close all the windows in the house and put on a Beethoven symphony for blast, but I can still hear him muffled under the music, barking, barking, barking. And now I can see him sitting in the orchestra, his head raised confidently, as if Beethoven has included a part for barking dog. When the record finally ends, he's still barking, sitting there in the oboe section barking, his eyes fixed on the conductor who is entreating him with his baton, while the other musicians listen in respectful silence to the famous barking dog solo, that endless coda that first established Beethoven as an innovative genius. Remember the title, Another Reason Why I Don't Keep a Gun in the House. Now, equanimity is really said to be the crown of the four Brahmaviharas. It's said to be their fruition, just as it's the fruition of the factors of awakening. It's one of the absorptions, it's one of the paramis or the perfections of heart. So equanimity features in many of the Buddha's lists of what it means to be an awake human being. In the quote I used in the beginning of the weekend, equanimity gives selflessness to metta. It gives patience, courage, and fearlessness to compassion. It guards joy from sentimentality. And it brings all of the noble qualities of the heart together in freedom. This is actually what the whole of the path is directed towards. It is equanimity that's deeply at the root of cooling the fires of greed, hatred, and delusion. If metta teaches us really to befriend all events and experiences, compassion teaches us the arts of empathy and responsiveness. Joy replenishes and restores the heart. And equanimity is really understanding what it means to stand in the midst of all experience with unshakable balance. It is often translated as to stand in the middle of. To stand in the middle of. Of course, this is nothing new. This is where we already stand. But it's how to stand there without the reactivity to the world of events and experience that so knocks us off balance. So we'd like to look at this quality of equanimity in a number of different domains that are universal, common to all of our lives. One of these domains is what does it mean to live with equanimity amidst the river of events and experiences that make up every human life, the 10,000 joys and sorrows, the experiences of change, of loss, the uncertainties, the unpredictable, little of which we control. And we see that every day our worlds are flooded with sense impressions. We already stand in the middle of all of this. And we learn to stand with a heart that cannot be shattered. Another domain of equanimity, but I think is you don't really find it so much in the early teachings, but I think it's quite central to our lives today, is to really explore what equanimity really looks like in the domain of human relationship. Our relationships with those that we love and care for, our relationships with people we struggle with and dislike and fear, and our relationship with those that we are more indifferent towards. Another domain of equanimity is what it means to be equally near the feeling tone, the Vedana tone of all experience, the pleasant, the unpleasant, and the neutral. Certainly in Buddhist psychology, this feeling tone of experience that is imprinted on consciousness with every sense impression, this second way of establishing mindfulness is truly recognized as being the place where we begin to fabricate our personal world of experience. I mean, increasingly in Western psychology, this feeling tone of experience is equally being acknowledged and recognized as being the trigger point for moving into craving or into aversion, into resistance or into pursuit. So what does it mean to be equally near the pleasant and the unpleasant and that which is neither pleasant or unpleasant? Another domain of equanimity is what the Buddha calls the signless, this is a really weird phrase, the signless deliverance of the mind. The signless deliverance of the mind. The understanding of what it means to live in a way where perception is not always loaded with association, where we are no longer kind of chopping this flow of events and sensory impressions actually into events or into things that are happening to me or creating a self in things. Creating a self in ourselves. So equanimity, again, like all of the other qualities that we've spoken about this weekend, this is a path, this is a cultivation, this is a capacity. And we see it's a path that's cultivated not so much in the calmest, most ideal moments of our lives. This is a path that we are asked to cultivate in the moments when we're most agitated, most shaken, most lost in reactivity. So equanimity, the way it's presented in the teaching, it's not presented again as a state. It's presented as an understanding, and it's presented as a way of being present. It's a practice of insight. It is something to embody. So let's take this domain of events and experiences, what we call the weather patterns of every human life. As the Buddha put it, praise and blame, gain and loss, pleasure and pain, success and failure are the eight worldly winds. They ceaselessly change. As a mountain is unshaken by the wind, the heart of a wise person is unshaken by all the changes on the earth. It's quite a big ask, isn't it? None of us are exempt from these extremes. Praise and blame touch us, success and failure, pleasure and pain, gain and loss. They blow through all of our lives, and what we really are asked to acknowledge is that these events of our lives, from which we're not exempt, they are not the same as our reactions to them. the events of our lives can touch us deeply. You know, they are not emotionally neutral. I think that's very important to acknowledge. Loss can be very sad. Pain can be quite sad and quite difficult. So these changes and these events are not emotionally neutral. So very important to really have a sense that equanimity is not a movement towards a sort of coldness or a lack of feeling or a lack of responsiveness. It is moving us towards calming the almost predictable reactivity that is associated with these extremes. Because we see in the face of these worldly events how we can easily swing, can't we? Between high and low, between excitement and boredom, between fear and hope, between elation and despair. And actually to really look at those swings and that reactivity and just how much agitation is built into it. And then how we feel very much again that our emotional world is actually hostage to the events that we cannot control. But we do try to control. We do try to control. You know, so much energy and so much effort can be dedicated to trying to arrange the conditions of our life so that we have only the pleasure and only the success and, you know, only the gain and only the praise, and doing our best to avoid their opposites. And again, this is where we live, as if our well-being of our hearts depends upon that world of events and conditions and trying to control it. You know, we may, if we're fortunate, have people who love us. We will likely have people who dislike us. We may, if we're fortunate, receive some praise in this life, and we're surely going to receive some blame. And at times, life does work out the way that we would wish it to, and we have our own measures of disappointment, that people are not who we think they should be, that we are not always the kind of person we think we should be. The word should is a big marker of beginning to move into imbalance. It's a big marker of beginning to move into the world of argument that we talked about earlier. This shouldn't be happening. Or this should be happening. You know, you should be this kind of person. I should be this person. You shouldn't be that kind of person. The word should, in my mind, is quite a big marker of beginning to move into that reactivity and into the argument. So it's not about emotional neutrality. It's not about trying to control conditions. A lot of equanimity is beginning to see where we're actually not standing in the middle of all of this. But we've actually pitched our tents, you know, elsewhere, in our mind's idea of how things should be. Now, the insight part of equanimity, remember we keep coming back, what are the insight parts of this quality? Well, one of the insight parts of equanimity is actually so deeply knowing about impermanence. Again, that familiar visitor. And so deeply knowing that we do not hold in our hands the power to dictate the ways in which conditions and events unfold. That's an in-the-bones type of knowing. You know, this is not an intellectual knowing. Equanimity relies upon an understanding of the three characteristics of change, of conditionality, of dukkha, of non-self. It's its foundation. But the development of equanimity keeps leading us back to a deeper understanding of those characteristics equally. So equanimity also knows that we do hold in our hands the tools and the developed capacity to respond with balance and compassion. So equanimity holds this discerning quality within it about knowing the difference between the events and the conditions unfolding and our reactivity to them. What is most designed to upset that sense of balance is probably evident to us. Again, those very familiar visitors we've mentioned so often over this weekend, craving, aversion, clinging. If you want to know a very direct way to being off balance, just do that. Simple. It's easy to read in our own experience. It's not hard to read. This is a place of, you know, great dissonance in our life, is that we often know the outcomes of our familiar patterns and we do them anyway. That terrible discomfort of being a spectator upon our own disasters. This is a period of, in most people's path and practice, that can last an uncomfortably long period of time. But I think it's good to recognize that it is a period in most people's practice, you know, of being a spectator. Yeah. You know, it's a problem with mindfulness. You know, you can't just turn it off when it doesn't serve you well. It's a problem with mindfulness. Nobody told you that when you began this path, that you're not going to always have the choice of when to be awake and when to know things. You're actually going to know it. So we're never short of these opportunities to actually really cultivate this balance. You know, it's about impulse calming. It's about impulse calming rather than impulse clinging. Calming those impulses, you know, that are so often so somatically felt when we begin to sort of lean into or lean away from, how to stand in the middle of that, how to stand not only in the middle of the events and experiences, but how to stand in the middle of our own reactivity instead of impulse feeding. It's a challenging one. It is where sometimes it's really helpful to come back to looking at this domain of equanimity, of the feeling tone of experience, the pleasant and the unpleasant, because recognizing the craving and aversion we find ourselves lost in is really rooted in that feeling tone and the automatic reactivity to them. Ah, pleasant sound, stand in the middle. Unpleasant sound, stand in the middle. Yeah? Pleasant sensation, unpleasant sensation, stand in the middle. You know, pleasant, unpleasant thought, stand in the middle. To stand in the midst of. This is a practice for our lives. This is not a practice just for our cushions. This is a practice for our lives because we underestimate how embedded and how automatic that movement is, you know, towards the pleasant and away from the unpleasant. It truly is a practice for our lives. By the way, this is a fast-track tour of equanimity. Short of time. So this domain of equanimity to me, which is the most challenging and probably the most overlooked, I think, in the early texts. So, you know, we have to be sort of a bit forgiving of going off in this direction, but for most people in their lives, it's the area that really matters, how to be equanimous in human relationship. You know, and we think that the monastics had it easier, you know, but they didn't have it easier, which is why they've got 327 rules to observe. Because they're ruled to govern every aspect of wayward human behavior. You know, and as lay people, we don't have 327 rules, you know, so we need equanimity. But this is the domain of our lives, I think, for most people, where they feel most vulnerable, where it's perhaps the place where they find themselves most knocked off balance. you know, human relationship is so complex, you know, and we live in a relationships that can be really so difficult to be with, you know, and we feel it deeply. You know, we feel deeply when we're exposed to the anger and rage of another, you know. We feel deeply when we're also touched by the love and care of others, you know. We feel deeply our own anger and resentment when it arises towards others. And we see the way that resentment just leeches joy from our lives. And, you know, we have to recognize that, we're in the time which is, you know, somewhat unusual in Buddhist history, you know, where there's a whole sort of teaching life, and actually much of the development of the path is actually far more in lay communities today than it is in monastic communities. And we actually don't have a lot of blueprints or a lot of maps for this domain of this very central domain of being a person, living in the world, living in relationship, living in times of conflict and struggle and strife and division, and actually how to develop this sense of equanimity in the midst of this, because without it, we're either going to be prone to close down or we're going to be prone to becoming part of the problem. You know, and so equanimity is really this middle path between this sort of dissociative mechanisms, you know, of numbness and withdrawal, or the other extreme of just the reactivity that is fueling the distress, both in our society, in our communities, in our families. So I think we do need to recognize that this is somewhat untraveled ground. And, you know, the Buddha certainly laid down maps about friendship, laid down maps about compassion, laid down maps about generosity and about being a good friend, but didn't lay down so many maps about equanimity in the midst of these complex relationships. I think we do see that we can be as knocked off balance by love as much as by hate. You know, both are somewhat joined in some weird way. You know, if you think in the midst of loving someone very deeply or hating someone very deeply, there's a shared obsession with the object of our love or our hate. And it is this shared obsession in which equanimity is lost. Equanimity is about balance, but I think mostly it's concerned with freedom. So we're not about coming to some sort, it's not about coming to some sort of state, but again coming to an understanding. It's really, you know, the Buddha says, you know, like so many of our habit patterns of reactivity are so embedded that they feel intractable. And, you know, you may recognize that in yourself, you know, oh, there I am again, you know, judging again, or anxious again, or fearful again, you know, or angry again. And the Buddha recognized, you know, this is no easy thing to actually come to some place of clarity and understanding with some of these reactive patterns that, you know, they feel like they've been with us our whole lives, and they feel like they were waiting for us when we were born. You know, we've inherited them, you know, family patterns of reactivity. I'm sure you know about these. So the Buddha was very, very conscious, you know, he didn't just say, let go, please. You know, anyone who's ever willed themselves to do such a thing has probably realized by now that letting go is not an act of will. It's not a response to a command. But it's an unbinding, you know, it's an unbinding, which is why we need to see equanimity as a practice. And the Buddha was a realist about this, about the embedded nature of reactivity. And he says, when you see these patterns of reactivity that, you know, arise so frequently, you know, here's a spectrum of responses, you know. And with each response that he offered, he would often follow with by the word, if it still arises.
You know, we would use the word again. You know, here I am again. He says, if it still arises. He says, first step always, you know, bring mindfulness to it. Know the felt sense. Know the felt sense of that pattern. Know the felt sense of anxiety. Know the felt sense of anger. Know the felt sense of impatience. Know where it starts to live in your body. Know the kind of story it picks up. Really bring this under the light of mindfulness. So if it still arises, this is really time to investigate. You know, what are the conditions that lead to that arising? Where are you most vulnerable? What set of conditions makes you most vulnerable to that arising? You know, how does it actually develop? You know, what does it rely upon for sustenance? You know, what does anxiety feed on? What does rage feed on? He says, if it still arises, take your attention elsewhere. Really being aware sometimes that the attention that we're bringing to the difficult is already flavored by the difficult. There's no such thing as bare attention. Attention is flavored. It's often flavored by our wish for something to go away, or by aversion, or anxiety about our anxiety, or aversion for our aversion. It says, take your attention elsewhere. It says, if it still arises, cultivate what's missing. You know, in the midst of anxiety, I might really experiment with cultivating groundedness, to really know what it feels like to touch the ground. In the midst of aversion, I may very well cultivate metta or compassion. In the midst of contractedness, I may very well cultivate a greater sense of spaciousness. Cultivate what's missing. It says, if it still arises, reflect on the outcomes. Where does this take me? Where, it's not a surprise to us, by the way. Usually takes us the same places. Where will this take me? It says, if it still arises, put your tongue against the roof of your mouth and don't go there. Sounds severe, but it's actually quite effective, I can promise you. It's quite effective. Just stop feeding it. Stop feeding it with any kind of attention or thought or anything. Just don't go there. You've got every scrap of insight you're ever going to glean. You know, the well is dry. The well is dry. There is no more insight to be had. All you're left with is the habit. Just don't go there. These are all kind of efforts directed towards cultivating this sense of not being bound by. It is the first step of equanimity, about finding some sense of balance. Now, equanimity, you know, you think about what it means in your relationships. What does it mean in relationships of love and tenderness? You know, those of you who are parents, those of you who are partners, you know, those of you who have dear friends, you know. What does equanimity mean in the face of those that you care deeply about, but also cannot control? You know, we care, many of us care for a lot of people in our lives. You know, children, friends, partners, parents. You know, we're often able to bring kindness, we're often able to bring compassion, but there's really a need for equanimity when we see those that we care about really making bad choices. You know, I have a pair of very elderly parents, you know, they've been making bad choices for 10 years at least. I mean, they probably made bad choices for 20 years before that. The last 10 years, you know, making such bad choices, you know. And you've seen that, anyone who has children or partners, you know, you see it. And there's so little you can do to control it, isn't it? So little you can care deeply. But they make people you care about maybe engaging in actions that can bring a waterfall of suffering upon themselves and others. You know, a student of mine whose son had a heroin addiction, you know, did everything that he as a loving parent could do to change that. And nothing worked. And then he said he went to an art gallery and he saw a painting of a woman standing at the edge of a river, seeing her child washed away in the current. And in this painting, the mother had no arms. And he said it was such a moment of epiphany for him to actually really deeply, deeply realize that as much as he loved and cared for his son, he did not have in his hands the power to control the courses of his son's mind. He said that was the insight. And isn't it so true? You know, people can love us and care about us, but I think we know that they don't have the power to change the course of our minds. You know, that really does lie in our hands. And there's such a point in that. There's such a poignancy in that. You know, to continue loving, to not give up, to continue caring, and yet to really somehow deeply in our bones recognize the limits of our control, the boundaries of our control. That's a big giving up of selfing. That's a big giving up of selfing, because so often in those situations we think we just haven't tried hard enough, or we haven't been good enough, or there's one more thing, you know, we go crazy with Google. You know, Google must have the answer, you know, about how to do this, you know. I mean, that's the latest fuel for our obsessions about fixing things. You know, Google must be able to figure it out, you know. But to really know that in our bones, you know, the limits to that power. It's such a deep level of acceptance in which there's no indifference and no paralysis of responsiveness. It doesn't mean that we stop endeavoring, but we actually really deeply know we do not have the power to change the course of another person's mind. I rather love the equanimity phrases. Because this life is but a play of joy and sorrow. May we remain unshaken by life's rise and fall. I care for you deeply, but you are the parent of your acts and the consequences. And sadly, I cannot keep you from distress. Sadly, I cannot keep you from distress. There's so much within that, the sense of care, the sense of connection, the sense of, you know, deep affection, but the deep recognition, you know, I sadly cannot keep you from distress because you are the parent of your acts, including your thought, mental acts. So this is actually the truth is of equanimity. Meditation is not intended to turn us into blocks of stone. We will feel deeply, but we can feel deeply in the context of understanding, in the context of insight, because without that, we flail at the world blindly. You know, endlessly trying to fix what is not within our power to fix. These are hard lessons to learn in our lives, but very important ones, because they are also the lessons actually that liberate other people, by the way, to find their ways. And sometimes not find their ways, but they do liberate people to actually find their ways. So to pause there, any questions, reflections about these parts? Yeah.
I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about, so you were talking about the different ways that you can kind of combine yourself, and so first to sort of feel it, where you can feel it in the body and so on, and then you talked about then maybe cultivating what's lacking, or cultivating what's needed.
Cultivating what's missing.
Okay.
No, I understand that. Did you hear the question? The dimension of cultivation I was speaking about, when you feel really stuck in something,
and the encouragement to cultivate what's missing, how you do that without turning that into what I should be feeling, you know, or into an aversion mechanism. No, it's a good question, because that's a very fine line. I mean, I think we do remember that the cultivation of equanimity and the cultivation of this kind of landscape of responses, shares in one dedication, which is about bringing distress to an end, and that's about bringing being stuck to an end. You know, so I think that it's probably a level of almost inner education, you know, to know when there's a kind of a compulsion to cultivate something that's missing. I don't like this. I really want to be spacious, you know, and you can sort of feel the compulsive element to it, which is actually still carrying or even recreating more distress and more stuckness. I think this is an art, you know. I think it's nuanced. I think you need to check this out for yourself. You know, if it is an aversion mechanism, it's probably going to be entirely unsuccessful. Put it that way. But if we can say to ourselves, okay, I'm really stuck in this, say, this contractedness. Really stuck in this contractedness. And it's unpleasant, you know, and I don't even particularly like it. You know, don't expect yourself to have this entirely altruistic, you know, romantic, oh yes, it's just fine. No, I actually don't really like being stuck in this contractedness. But let's experiment with what it means to, what it would feel like to cultivate some spaciousness, the spaciousness that's missing. You know? So it doesn't mean necessarily that the contractedness goes away, but maybe the contractedness can sit in the spaciousness. You know? So it's a kind of reorienting of our attention, which relies upon interest, relies upon curiosity, relies upon some experimentation, relies upon, you know, it's not trying to make something happen. It's actually see, what do I cultivate in the midst of this? But I think this is very nuanced, you know. There's plenty of disguised aversion mechanisms, you know, that can look good, but they're actually still aversion. So I think this takes some experimenting. Yes, please. In your place of employment. Mm.
I realized in one of those experiences
Yeah, it does. I mean, you know, this is something I would want to really highlight in there. I mean, I think there's a, you know, there's a meditative neurosis that I bump into quite a lot in people where, you know, they can listen to the teaching and then almost adopt this almost kind of view, you know, that the problem is all in here. Everything out there, that's not the problem. The problem is all in here. Yeah, sometimes it's really out there. Sometimes it really is out there, and it, you know, I could be equanimous and accepting and compassionate and filled with metta, and there is still a problem out there that needs addressing. Yeah, with what was out there. Yeah, I think that's really true, because otherwise we're in collusion, actually. Dukkha's feeding on dukkha. You know, and we know work patterns like that. We know family patterns like that, you know, where dukkha just feeds on dukkha, you know. And until something else is kind of dropped into that pot, you know, like equanimity or like metta or like compassion, it doesn't change, you know. And that is, as you say, the part that we can take, that we can actually cease to be part of the collusion. Then maybe, it's very interesting in relationship, isn't it? Like when we change, it's often an invitation for that around us to change. It's not that invitation isn't always taken up, but it's there. Okay, anybody else got anything else? All your relationships are clear and happy and harmonious. Okay, I want to come across this what is called this last domain of equanimity, which, you know, awkwardly is framed as the signless deliverance of the mind. It's actually talking about how we make our world. And some of you will be familiar with the sutta in the Adana collection that's named in praise of equanimity. It goes, "For one who clings, motion exists." Let's unpack it a little bit. "For one who clings, motion exists." This is a polite way of saying that for one who clings, there is agitation. Moving towards, moving away, trying to fix, trying to get rid of. So for one who clings, motion exists. But for one who does not cling, there is no motion. No motion. It's coming to that place of still poise. Still poise. Where no motion is, there is stillness. Where stillness is, there is no craving. Where no craving is, there is neither coming or going. Where no coming or going is, there is no arising nor passing away. There is neither this world and a world beyond, nor a state between. This verily is the end of dukkha. It's quite a profound piece, you know. There is so much in it. It's backtracking a little bit from what we've talked about in those continuums, you know. When clinging actually stills, that so does craving. When craving stills, so does the world of reactivity of moving towards. When craving stills, when there's neither coming nor going, there is neither this world nor another world. There's no world of fabrication. There's no personal world of experience being built. This is so much part of the Buddhist teaching, is to understand how our personal world of experience is fabricated and built and constructed, and actually how it's often built and constructed really on the basis of the continuum of feeling tone, craving aversion, clinging, becoming self. It's that cognitive chain I used in the talk on Friday night, you know, where there is contact, there is feeling, what we feel, we perceive, what we perceive, we proliferate about, what we proliferate about, we dwell upon, what we dwell upon becomes the shape of our mind, and the shape of our mind becomes the shape of our world. It's that cognitive chain of construction and fabrication that we can all see in our own experience. Now, the point actually, when the Buddha talks about signless, he's talking about signless as the opposite of sign-making. Perception is sign-making. So what we contact, we feel, what we feel, we perceive. At that point, actually, we place a name upon things. You know, man, woman, light, fog, sound, you know, bird, you know, truck, we place a sign upon them. The name that is designated tends to sum up a whole world of past experience. It's like Wittgenstein's quote, words deliver us a picture, and the picture holds us captive. The picture holds us captive. Now, as I mentioned earlier today, the second basic function of mindfulness is to clean up the field of perception. You know, as William Blake put it, you know, if the doors of perception were cleansed, the world would appear as it is, infinite. But we see that our doors of perception, that perception is not, perception does not come to the party alone. Perception brings to the moment how we have experienced and perceived something before. Emotionally, experientially. So with when perception is loaded with those associations and those memories, we very rarely see something anew. What we see is finiteness. We see the limits, you know, we see the finiteness of something. I sort of name the sound truck, you know, and it's finite, you know. I see you, and I've seen you before. I had a particular experience with you in the past, and I only need to see you and have a name for you, and that's who you are. You know, it's like the greatest act of compassion we could ever have for another person is to liberate them from the fixed perceptions that we have about them. It's probably the greatest act of compassion we could have for ourselves is to liberate ourselves from the fixed views and perceptions that we hold about ourselves, because this is where finiteness is created. And it's like a life sentence, isn't it? It's like a life sentence, you know. It's like that, you know, you were like that, you are like that, you will always be like that. You know, that's who you are. You know? So perception is carrying all of those memories, and they have, it's emotional memories. It's not neutral, it's emotional memory. It's somatic memory, you know. And this is how we find safety and meaning in the world, is by placing signs or names, by knowing something. It's how we find safety and meaning. And most of this is happening at such an unconscious level that, you know, it just gets lost in the sea of our thinking. So, you know, I mean, just test that out in your experience. How many unknowns do you actually have in your relationships, in your life? And how much we rely upon that knowing to actually sort of fix things in place. It's safety, it's meaning, it's a way of trying to control things, it's a way of trying to protect ourselves from being surprised. To protect ourselves from being surprised. You know, even though we perhaps on one level recognize that our ability to grow and deepen as a human being relies upon our capacity to be surprised, part of us just does not want to be surprised because we equate that with somehow being disturbed. So one of the primary jobs of mindfulness is actually to strip perception of fixed views. The fixed views carried through emotional memory that gets associated with perception. It's kind of like the secret, the alchemy of what mindfulness is. It's what allows us to see all things anew. It's what allows us to change. It's what allows other people to change. And that might be uncomfortable for us, but it actually allows us to move into a world that feels more infinite than finite. So that's basically the signless deliverance of the mind. It's fairly straightforward, isn't it? It doesn't mean that perception is disabled, by the way. We cannot get through life without navigational perception. But it means that perception, as that particular function of psychological ability, it does not have fixed views attached to it. Has anybody got any questions about that? Yes, please.
When you just said that, I brought up this thing that I've been struggling with. My mom and I have become a lot closer since my stepfather died. We just have more time to spend together without another person there. And I've been really confused as to why there's this, and I feel it's coming from me, this distance that or this wall that I put up sometimes. My mom is being herself, and
It's really important. It's really sensing that frozenness. You know, I mean, you know, I see in my family, you know, my father now at 91, you know, with severe dementia and all kinds of physical disability, and he's kind of like a wounded puppy, you know. But when I first see him, I see the father that I knew for the first 87 years, which was the father who was always enraged and angry and all the rest of it. And it takes that adjustment to see, oh yes, that's actually not who he is now. You know, who he was required one set of responses. Who he is now requires a totally different set of responses, but it also requires our willingness to move past. It doesn't mean that frozen perception doesn't arise, but you feel it, you sense it. And that, you know, you sort of see a choice moment there. You could actually sit back in there of what was and the frozenness of that, or you could sit in the midst of what is now and it's not frozen. But you can see there's almost a choice moment there. You know, there can be sort of a holding to what was, because, you know, I haven't quite done my payback yet, or whatever, you know. However grossly we want to put that, you know. Haven't quite done my punishment enough. Or I could just liberate that. It's also really being aware that in those kind of perceptions that are carrying those frozen views, you know, that is how we invest a self in all things. And we see that self as somehow having an independent existence rather than a self that has been invested through our aversions and cravings and fears and anxieties. It's a self that has been posited within something that is actually fluid and dynamic and unfolding. And by positing that self in through perception, through name, we're actually freezing something that by nature is actually unfolding and dynamic. can do this externally, we can do this internally. Yes, please. Moments of
being equanimous, where we would be able to strip away some of the perceptions when we.
Of course. I mean, I think when we, you know, when we hear the word, you know, upekkha and nibbana used interchangeably, we actually have to really see that the path is never separate from the goal, you know. So you have to see of yourself as practicing nibbana. You know, when you're cultivating equanimity, you're actually practicing nibbana, you know. And whatever we practice, we do get better at, both the wholesome and the unwholesome. Mm-hmm. And so there is a path and there is a fruition of the path. But the fruition of the path is not separate from that cultivation. You know, so equanimity is truly an understanding that we cultivate and practice. And as I mentioned, not usually in the calmest moments of our lives. Usually in the most ruffled moments. Yes, please. How information gets. Yes, but it's not emotional knowledge. It's not emotionally imprinted historical knowledge. Yeah, that's the difference. So the difference is, you know, how do we do? You know, there's a lot of historical knowledge that is carried through perception that is very necessary for us to be a functional human being. It means we don't have to keep learning how to drive our car every time we get in it, you know. We actually know how to do this. So there's a lot of, there is historical knowledge built within every perception. The difference is whether that historical knowledge is purely navigational, which is helpful and useful and serves us well, or whether that historical knowledge is emotional, distorted historical knowledge, or fixed. Yeah? Yes, please.
Can you clarify that? So it's not that our emotions part of creating the distortion?
It's both. Our emotions part of creating the distortion. Yes, you had a very difficult, you know, if you had a difficult relationship with your mother at a certain time in your life, you know, then you see your mother, you don't see your mother as she is just now. You see actually your mother through the lens of that historical knowledge, that emotional, so that emotion is actually distorted the perception of the moment. You know, that emotion may have been quite accurate at a certain point, but the emotion is being woven into the perception. You know, it's like, you know, Freddie Jean, you know, just comes in late twice, you know, closes the door loudly twice, you know, and I can see Freddie Jean 10 years later, and oh, there's the one who closes the door so noisily, you know. So the emotion is actually distorting. You know, I don't know why Freddie Jean closes the door so noisily, you know. Maybe they're hard of hearing. They don't even know they close the door noisily, you know. I don't know why. I know my aversion, you know, I might know my aversion to it, you know. So it's my aversion to it that actually gets woven into the perception, you know. And the aversion is actually built on a complete absence of information. You know, it's simply my reactivity. And yet it gets woven into the perception. So, you know, surely whoever, you know, is always sentenced for life to be the person who closes the door noisily. That's who they are. Yes, please.
One of the difficulties that I have in trying to integrate an understanding of the illusions of perception is that as I do that, struggle to do that, it is very challenging to others who are important to me, right? And you begin to understand.
Why is it challenging to them?
Because their perception of you, their perception of yourself is a construction.
Yeah.
And it may not be a construction anymore that makes any sense.
Yeah.
But it's extremely threatening
yeah.
to the relationship.
Yeah.
And I get stuck in that because there's always a pull towards being the self that you're no longer.
Oh, tell it. Well, no, it's so true. I mean, isn't that family tradition? You know, everybody thinks they're a good meditator till they go home for Thanksgiving dinner. You know, where you're supposed to take a certain seat, you know, and you're supposed to be a certain kind of person and react in a certain kind of way, because that's who you are, and that's what keeps the sort of whole family equilibrium going, is by everybody obeying the rules of our shared and collective perceptions of each other, you know. And the moment somebody actually doesn't fit in, the whole family equilibrium is down the chute. Everybody knows this, you know, or a lot of people know this anyway, you know. And so one person changes and suddenly everybody's kind of a little bit squirmy, you know, because like you're not supposed to change, you know, you're supposed to actually always be that person who did this. So, but that takes a lot of sensitivity and care, I think, to navigate those changes, you know, to really sense how much we're, you know, even feeling the need to be heard by somebody else. You know, rather than just being comfortable in those changes that are going on inwardly without the need to be heard and recognized and visible. You know, it's so interesting, you know, that can be such a big piece of it. You know, I need to be heard, I need to be understood, you know, especially by those who love me. No, we don't. My mother asked me last week when if I was a Muslim. I don't know why she asked me this. I'm fine to be a Muslim, but I have no idea where it came from, you know. It's like, oh, she says, no, you're not a Muslim. You're one of those Buddhists. You know, she's 89 years old. She has no idea what I do. It's a great liberation to have no need to be recognized or validated or anything that by anyone else, you know. They can do their whole dance around who you are and you can just, that's fine, you know, be whoever you like me to be, you know, if you like me to be. You know, but it's a great liberation, you know, because you need to be aware of that, how much, you know, as we change, we almost want to be validated, you know, we want to be understood, we want to be visible. Totally human, but we don't need it. We don't need it, you know. We can just change. It's a very seductive trap to actually feel, well, you know, you're the people closest to me in my life. I hope that you see actually the changes that are going on, you know, or the way that I'm not who I was, you know. But if we can liberate that one of needing to be validated, it's a great service for everyone.
But it's also to not be punished.
It's also to not be punished, yeah. That's why we need to be so careful in navigating these relational changes, you know, because sometimes we sort of feel, you know, change going on inwardly, and we sort of anticipate that that would be even a great kindness if others could change too. You And maybe they don't want to. You know, maybe they're very resistant and, you know, and aren't interested. And or maybe they want to punish you for, you know, surprising them, you know. So this is all part of this fabric of equanimity, of finding the freedom in fluidity without that needing to be supported. Don't do that. Don't start teaching people, especially those closest to you. It is best not to start teaching them. They very rarely welcome it, in my experience. Okay, so just, you know, coming back to where we started out this weekend, you know, that beautiful quote by Long Chanpa, you know, that out of the soil of friendliness grows a beautiful bloom of compassion, watered by the tears of joy and sheltered beneath the cool shade of the tree of equanimity. I think it's so important to really recognize that equanimity never leaves metta behind. It never leaves compassion behind. It never leaves joyfulness behind, but actually is pervaded and imbued with all of those qualities. So it is not about becoming this sort of, yeah, this block of stone or this sense of indifference. It's actually imbued. If it's not imbued with all of those qualities, it's probably not equanimity. It probably is its near enemy of indifference. So equanimity carries all of those qualities and brings them together as a sort of completeness, or what the Buddha refers to, the unshakable liberation of the heart through the awakening of these qualities. It's almost, within the Brahma Viharas, you can almost sense like a musical scale, you know, how different situations in our life, you know, that wisdom question of what is going on here, and the compassion question of what does this need. You know, so it's not this progressive developmental path necessarily. You know, there may be moments of, and it's always about bringing distress to an end. You know, what is needed right just now, it might be more joyfulness. It might be a greater sense of compassion. It might be a greater sense of stillness. It might be a greater sense of kindness. So it's to feel that one has at hand this kind of scale of responsiveness, which is always concerned with healing, is concerned with awakening, is concerned with liberating. And to be able to develop these as practices, you know, I think this is most important, you know. They really require time and commitment and effort and energy to actually develop these as practices, as cultivations, as bhavana, to bring into being, you know, to nourish and to nurture and to bring into being. But they're not complicated practices, you know, and also please bear in mind that there's not a right way to do this. You know, as I mentioned, the Buddha was pretty unprescriptive in terms of technique, you know? So there's almost a sense of experimentation here, you know? What would it look like to cultivate more friendliness here, more befriending, you know? Would it mean using the phrases, you know? Would it mean actually just recalling to mind what actually the felt sense of metta actually is? You know, with equanimity, it might mean, you know, does this mean some restraint? You know, does this mean learning to bear discomfort? Does this mean continually showing up even when, you know, everything in me says run? You know, these are life experiments, you know. They're not, it's not like there's a right way or a right, you know, a right technique, so to speak, you know. You really need to avail ourselves of what's available, but also to feel like that is not prescriptive. It is not prescriptive. It's almost, and being aware that all of these qualities of the heart that were spoken about, that the cultivation is always intention-led. It's always intention-led. You know, the intention to befriend, the intention to cultivate empathy or responsiveness, you know, the intention to cultivate joyfulness, the intention to cultivate balance and poise, and that intentionality really relies upon having sufficient mindfulness in place, having sufficient discernment in place about what leads to distress and what leads to the end of distress, and in the midst of that, really cultivating that intentionality, that sense of bringing into being, bringing into being. Bearing in mind that in the Buddhist teaching, in the early teachings, you know, the unbinding from distress does not come because we sort of pick away at it. That the unbinding of distress comes into being through the cultivation of the lovely and the healing and the liberating. And this is what actually does the unbinding and the letting go, not because we have worked on things or worked things out or improved things or fixed things, you know, but because we have dedicated ourselves to really cultivating the lovely, including the Brahma Viharas, that this is what does the unsticking and the unbinding. And that, by the way, is a really important reorientation to make, because, you know, when we're in the pathway of working on things or improving things, you know, there's a great centralization of me in that. And when we actually reorient and focus towards cultivating and bringing into being the lovely, there is far more less of a centralization of me in that. But this is actually, in the texts, in the teachings, you see far more spoken about this sense of cultivation and growing and nourishing than you see anything spoken about hammering away at the unwholesome. Okay, so I think that's what I'd like to do. Could we just take 5 minutes to sit? I know we've said we want to be ended by 3:30 this afternoon, so I'm going to take a few minutes. Thanks. I'm very aware in teaching at so many different places, both residential and non-residential places, I'm always aware of how much goes on behind the scenes to allow teachings to happen through, you know, board members, volunteers, you know, people who, you know, put out cushions and clean up. And I'm aware that's as true as Sims as anywhere. And so I really want to thank everyone who, in their own way, really contributes to, you know, allowing and supporting these teaching sessions and classes, etc., to really happen, and the long history that many of you have with actually volunteering your time and your energy, and you know how, you know, this is really about Sangha and about Sangha building. I also want to thank you, you know, your attention over this weekend. But, you know, more than that, I'm very aware. Actually, nobody quite knows how long I've been coming here, but it's a very long time. In maybe 17, 18, 19 years, something like that. So some of you in this room I've actually known for many, many, many years. And, you know, as you know, this is my last time of coming here as I'm disappearing from America. For many complex reasons. Many complex reasons, which I won't endeavor to go into the long story of those reasons right now. But anyway, I'm not getting a visa renewal after the visa that it expires that I have now. So this will be my last time, and I really want to thank you. You know, I'm very sensitive and I'm very appreciative, you know, of this Sangha. And I want to say I really wish you well in your, both individually, but I really also wish you well as a Sangha, that you do continue to grow and to flourish and to thrive as you have done, you know, for many years now. No matter where your home is or where you land, you know, those conditions change, but actually really to really see the difference and the, you know, the reality that the Buddha taught of how important community actually is. So I thank you. I thank you. And I wish you well. And now probably someone's going to tell you about how to put away the chairs, because that's part of being here.
And Christine, I just want to, you know, deeply thank you for all these years of sharing the Dharma. It's probably close to 20, I think.
I think it's something like that.
And it's, you know, I can speak for many years, as to myself, has been a very significant part of my training. And, you know, Christine has really helped a lot behind the scenes with advice and mentoring. And we've been very privileged to have such a senior, wise teacher come for so many years. So thank you.
You're welcome.
And Deborah is coming up.